Okay, good evening everyone. If you have a webcam, please hit the send video button. Again, this is Rabbi Jeff Sachs of Web Yeshiva Atid in our continuing series on Jews, Judaism, and modernity, topics in modern Jewish history. Tonight, we're talking about the Cantonist system, the accursed, forced army service for young Jewish children in Tsarist Russia. I just wanted to point out, someone had asked this question. There's this notes panel on the right hand side of the board. There's a box called notes, which you can access from the icons on the upper right hand side. It looks like a little pencil writing on a notebook. That's a notebook that you can use to keep notes. That's as opposed to the chat, which is disseminated either to everyone or one-on-one. The notes is private. Whatever you write there, when you hit the save button, it gets saved on your computer only. That's a handy feature which you can take advantage of. Again, if you have a video, hit the send video button. And if you don't have a video, do me a favor and go out and get yourself a video so we can see you. The policy in Tsarist Russia became very reactionary at a certain point. We had talked in the past about the Congress of Vienna in 1815, after the war between France and Russia, really the war between France and much of Europe, but certainly after the invasion of Russia, Napoleon's invasion of Russia, and the Congress of Vienna in 1815, which dealt with, among many, many other topics, dealt with the Jewish question. Again, let me just rephrase this. The Jewish question, which is the question for modern Jewish history, is what are we going to do with these Jews? Who are these people living amongst us? They're not like us, as I'm speaking in the voice of the Christian majority. They're not like us. They're datehem shonot. They have different practices. They have a different religion. They have different beliefs. They're other. They're very other than us, say the Christian majority. They're demonic. Maybe they're responsible for the untimely demise of our Messiah, say the Christians. They are oppressive of us. Even though we're in charge, somehow they're pulling the strings, the financial strings, the economic strings. In Russia, we spoke about how the Jews, because of their weird position in the economic ladder, are somehow responsible, or viewed rather as being responsible, for the fact that you have these masses and masses of peasants and serfs who are basically forced into being alcoholics because they're paid in liquor. And the person that makes those payments is the Jewish innkeeper or person responsible for supervising the tenants on the estate. And it creates a very bad situation for the Jews. In Western Europe, we saw it in our previous discussion. This question of what should we do with the Jews is given, the Jewish question, is given many different answers over the course of the centuries, including, well, we can convert them, we can convert them forcibly, we can convert them beneficently, we can help them see the light, we can kick them out, we can beat up on them, until ultimately, of course, someone will get the idea, in about 110 years down the timeline from where we're standing tonight, that, well, maybe we should just kill them all. And that solution, of course, was termed the final solution, because you know, it was at least conceived to be, you know, the sof pasuk, the end of the discussion, because after they're all dead, well, then the question will ameliorate itself. We won't have to figure out what to do with the Jews, because there won't be any more Jews. Well, of course, that was not the final solution. It was only maybe the penultimate attempt at a solution. And the final solution is actually the idea that, well, maybe the Jews don't belong here, maybe because they need to go back to a place all their own. Hopefully, in the course of due time, we'll get to a discussion of the rise of Zionism. But it's important now to foreshadow that in our story, you know, with that notion that the Jews are really... You know, their presence here causes problems, and in the attempt to find a solution to those problems, all types of strange things are going to be suggested. Let me just check here. Okay, just looking on the chat for a second. Okay, again, if you have any questions, feel free to chat or to draw my attention or to speak up. I'll be very happy to have people speaking up on the microphone. By around 1825, most of the rural Jews in the Pale of Settlement had been moved to the steppes, to that area. I'm sorry I didn't put up the map, but you should hopefully have that map. You know, the southern areas of the Pale of Settlements, which the Russian government, part of their idea was to populate those sparsely populated areas to create a foothold in those territories. So a lot of the Jews had been resettled to those steppes, or had been resettled to the cities, to the urban centers. The Russians had thought that the Jews would give up innkeeping and would abandon that middle space that they occupied in the economy that we described, and that would, of course, you know, relieve all of the tensions that were created by that circumstances. But they didn't realize that Jews would flock to the cities. And in the cities, very, very many of them would be homeless and would be jobless, creating all types of other problems, that Jews would do that instead of going off and happily picking up their hoes and rakes and pitchforks and becoming farmers, which is what the central government had thought they would do. In 1825, Alexander I, who we discussed previously, Alexander I died and was succeeded by his brother, Nicholas I, who is sire from 1825 to 1855, had a particularly long reign. He, Nicholas is anti-liberal. He is very rigid. He's militaristic. I mean, just look at this picture of the handsome fellow. I mean, he's, you know, like, you know, if you wear those, what are these things called? These epaulets, you know, the things that look like brushes on the shoulders. You have to be really into it, I guess, to wear those, although perhaps they were in fashion at a certain time. He's, you know, an anti-Semite of the good old fashioned order. And in 1827, very shortly into his reign, he comes up with this idea of the cantonist system. A canton is a region, and the idea being, or a unit, a type of military unit. The idea being that, although of course there had been for a while a mandatory draft, which included in principle the Jews, the idea being that that the Jews were not suited for military service, and you couldn't just draft a young Jew at the age of 18 and put him into the army alongside his Russian compatriot, because it's not fair. The Jew isn't trained. He's not physically fit. He's not ready to go into the army, and therefore, the Jews have to undergo some kind of pre-military training, a type of juvenile training, a hakshara, as we call it in a very different context in Hebrew. And that was the Cantonist system, that between the ages of 12 and 18, Jews were drafted into this kind of pre-military training unit. And then at 18, they embark on their regular military service, which in principle, on paper, lasted for 25 years. So you were in army training, basic training as it were, for 6 years from the age of 12 to 18, and then you had a 25-year stint in the army. Now, not everybody went to the army. Not everybody was drafted, and even those that were drafted, not everybody went. And not everybody that went ended up going for 25 years. But it was a long haul. I mean, my goodness, to think that you were going to be in the army from the age of 12 to the age of 43, it was really, really quite daunting. Interestingly, Nicholas came up with this idea on his own, without consulting his advisors, without a committee. It was an idea. I don't know. Maybe it came to him. Maybe it came to him one day, you know, one day in the bathtub or something like that. And you always have to be suspicious of any totalitarian leader that comes up with an idea, you know, on his own and thinks that it's, this is the way to go, because, you know, when you're the Tsar of Russia and you have an idea, no matter what brand of lunacy it might be, one imagines that you're surrounded by a lot of yes men who are, you know, not really in a position to dissuade you for why it might not be such a great idea. This is the document that outlines the regulations of how the whole system worked. I don't want to spend time going through the whole thing. Interestingly, I'll go into this in a second. The responsibility for fulfilling the military obligations falls upon the Jewish communities themselves. That the draft was meant to be administered by the kihilah, by the Jewish community itself. And that was really the cruelest trick of all, because quotas were placed on each community, and the community officials themselves, if they didn't come up with the quotas, they themselves would have to go. And of course, that was the last thing that they wanted to do. There were exemptions to who was eligible for the draft, so that if you were a member of a guild, if you were a student, if you were a graduate of university or secular education, if you practiced particular crafts or had some factory skills, or if you worked in agriculture, all of the things that the government had wanted the Jews to go do, and which in very small numbers Jews actually did, if you did those things, you were exempt from going to the army. So that was certainly an incentive to move into those kinds of quote-unquote productive trades, but that left still plenty of people eligible for the draft, including yeshiva students, unskilled workers, etc. Interestingly, one of the exemptions, in addition to merchants, rabbis were also exempt from military service, assuming they can show proper documents proving that they are in fact rabbis. Why might rabbis be exempt from military service? Any thoughts on that? Brian, I'll come back to your question in a second. What do you mean by that, Sherry? No, I mean, that's true, but not... Sherry says that because their first allegiance is to God, you know, which is true. But... No, it's true that that's true, but that's not why the government was interested in exempting them. Why might the government not want rabbis in the army? Right, exactly, Brian. One of the main, if not the main agenda behind this mass draft of the Jews and the taking away of Jewish children to the pre-military units was to assimilate them, was to distance them from religion. If you're a 12-year-old and you're taken away from your family, and we'll describe the conditions in a moment, and you're sent off to the Russian army, and you don't go home again until you're 43 years old, you're probably not going to be putting on tefillin every day and keeping kosher and Shabbat and etc. And in fact, that's what happens. And if you'd had rabbis there alongside the other troops, that would serve as a counterforce to the overall goal of trying to obliterate Jewish commitment and observance. And that's why rabbis are exempt from going to the army, because their presence would be disturbing to the real unspoken but hardly hidden goal of what the whole Cantonist system was about. Brian had asked about what were the Jewish trades. If you look in the archives, I actually discussed this at some length in the first session, I think 3 weeks ago. But basically 30% of the Jewish population was occupied in innkeeping and leases, that middleman position, middle management in managing the entire serf system, which is in place in Russia until the 1860s, and managing estates of the landowners, which again creates this very difficult position for the Jew. Another third were involved in trade and things of that nature, and about 20% had no fixed occupation, which might mean that they were poor or that they engaged in all different types of, odd jobs to eke by, etc. And then there were 15% or so that were involved in various crafts, like shoemaker, tailor, and whatnot. And again, in 1800, in the year 1800, only 1% of the Jewish population of the Pale of Settlement, only 1% was involved in agriculture. And as I pointed out a few times, Russia is always concerned with producing enough food to feed those amounts of people. So involvement in agriculture is really quite essential. The system by which the Jewish community itself is responsible for filling the quotas of who goes off to the army is, again, it's particularly cruel, it's particularly oppressive, it's certainly designed to undermine Jewish allegiance to their own Jewish communal authorities. It may not be surprising that the middle class and up, that the taxpayers to the Jewish community think that the kids of the poor folk should be the first to go. Unpleasant in a really unpleasant feature, there was this institution of the chappers. You know what it means to chap something, like we say in Yiddish. To chap means to grab. The chappers were basically the grabbers, the kidnappers, as it were, who went around chapping kids to fill the quotas, or to chap kids from neighboring towns in order to fill the quotas of your own town. And apparently, by some accounts, these chappers weren't even always so careful to get 12-year-olds, sometimes younger kids, 8, 9, 10-year-olds were taken just to fill the numbers. Sherry asks about non-Jewish children. No, in other words, this idea of the juvenile units, that was for the Jewish community. Other Russians had to serve long military stints, but from the age of 18. Natalie asks, rabbis in the Russian army might have gained more influence than Russian priests. You mean, Natalie, you mean on the non-Jewish population? Yeah, maybe, although I'm not sure that they... It's possible. The motivations behind the system were to, obviously, to weaken the Jewish community because of the negative feelings created by this quota system, to drive a wedge between the rich, basically, who can buy themselves out. In other words, if you were able to pay, you were able to buy a pass, as it were, for your own children, and the poor, who obviously could not afford it, to create resentment towards and opposition to the communal leaders who were forced to manage the system. And then, of course, like I said, to alienate Jewish kids, Jewish youth, from Torah and mitzvot, from commitment to their religion, and to the Jewish people. The Russian army officers would try to influence them with a heavy hand to convert to the Greek Orthodox Church, to Russian Catholicism. Certainly, there was no option for tefillin, for tzitzit, for Shabbat, for kashrut. These things are impossible. And while the children were in the Cantonist units, Christian religious training was mandatory. That was part of their army training, was to undergo basically, forms of brainwashing, as it were. So it's not surprising that kids that were taken off to these units, if they didn't, simply die from famine or disease or dysentery, or being in the Russian army for a couple of decades is certainly raises your mortality rate, that you're going to die of some other cause, including a bullet to the head. But it's not surprising that very, 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 very few kids that go in come out, or come out as Jews. While looking for a photograph to include on the slideshow, on the Wikipedia page, I discovered. I'm not sure what the source for this was. That there were only on the Cantonist page on Wikipedia, there's an entry for somebody named Herzl Yankel Tzam, who, according to Wikipedia, was only one of 8 Jewish officers in the Russian army in the 19th century. In theory, Jews could have advanced in the Russian army, but in reality, they didn't. Of the thousands, in the thousands of children that went in, only 8 became officers over the entire period of the Cantonist system. And this Herzl Yankel Tzam apparently was one of the very few who was able to maintain some kind of connection to Judaism, although he personally suffered all types of discrimination. There's somebody by the name of Alexander Herzen. Let me find him. Where is he? Here he is. Here's Alexander Herzen. Alexander Herzen, he was born 1812 to 1870. He was, at the time, a very well-known Russian author who was a liberalist reformer. Apparently, Herzen was one of the main forces behind the emancipation of the serfs. At the same time that the United States emancipated its slaves, Russia emancipated its serfs. You know, who were these indentured servants to the landowners, and they were emancipated in different stages over the 1860s. And Herzen was really one of the leading liberal voices and reformist forces in Russia that helped move that along. Because of this, of course, he was himself persecuted by the government, and he was sent out to exile for a period of time. In a book, there's a book called, here it is, let me hold it up to the camera, it's always good to see actual real books. There's a book called, 2 volumes, History of the Jews in Russia and Poland by Simon Dubnow, it's spelled Dubnow, D-U-B-N-O-W, but it's pronounced Dubnow. Here it is, published in English. It was written in Russian, actually, published in English in 1918 by the Jewish Publication Society. Here is a copy of it, which I came to possession of in a used bookstore years ago. Although I discovered that this and so many other things, the entire book is available online on Google Books, because it's of course no longer under copyright. It's in the public domain. So Dubnow, if you ever come to visit, Sherry was in Israel not long ago, visiting us from Hawaii, because, you know, I guess that's what you do if you live in Hawaii. You come to Yerushalayim to visit. So she came to visit us in the office, but we weren't there. But if you come to visit us in the office, around the corner from the Web Yeshiva office is Rehov Dubnow, named after Simon Dubnow, the great pioneering Jewish historian, who wrote this important 2-volume work of the Jews of Russia and Poland. So he writes the following in his description of the Cantonists: how these unfortunate youngsters were driven to their places of destination, we learn from the description of Alexander Herzen. So Dubnow quotes some piece of writing of Herzen, which I'm sure exists only in Russian, but we have it from a secondary source, from Dubnow, quoting from Herzen's diaries, who chanced to meet a batch of Jewish Cantonists on his involuntary journey through Vyatka in 1835. So in 1835, Herzen is sent on his own exile. He's not Jewish. Herzen wasn't Jewish. He was a Russian liberal writer and thinker and reformist. He's sent into exile, and as he's going off to exile, I'm not sure, I apologize, I don't know where Vyatka is, but it's, you know, like the Gulag, although I don't know exactly where it is. You can maybe Google it and find it on a map. And as he's going, he bumps into this group of Jewish Cantonists, these kids, these little kids. At one of the post stations in some godforsaken village of the Vyatka government, he met the escorting officer. The following dialogue ensued between the two. So this is the text, as recorded by Herzen, of his discussion with the Russian officer in charge of a unit of these Cantonists. Like, imagine being a Russian army officer, and you're given, I don't know how many kids were in a unit, but let's say there were, I don't know, 40, 50, 60, 12-year-olds is like being a camp counselor. It's like being a sadistic camp counselor. So Herzen asks the officer, whom do you carry and to what place? Meaning, where are you going? Right, like Hitler Youth. So the officer says, well, sir, you see, they got together a bunch of these accursed Jewish youngsters between the ages of 8 and 9. So you see, by the officer's testimony itself, the law is from the age of 12 and up. But in reality, the kids are even younger. This group that he's escorting, they're 8 or 9 years old. I suppose they're meant for the fleet, but how should I know? At first, the command was to drive them to Perm. Now there's a change. We're told to drive them to Kazan. Again, you can look on a map to see where these places are, but basically, you take these little kids, 8, 9-year-old kids, you march them through the snow from here to there, and then from there to there, and you assume a bunch of them are going to drop dead along the way, and that's going to solve some of your problems. I've had them on my hands for 100 versts or thereabout. It's a measure of distance. The officer that turned them over to me told me they were an awful nuisance. A third of them remained on the road. At this, the officer pointed with his finger to the ground, meaning a third of them dropped dead. Half of them won't get to their destination, he added. So Herzen hears that these kids are going off, and he's told that half of them are gonna drop dead along the way. So he assumes epidemics, I suppose. I inquired, stirred to the very core. So he assumes that the reason that these kids are dropping like flies is because there's dysentery, or there's some disease, or there's some machala. So the sergeant says, no, not exactly epidemics, but they just fall like flies. Well, you know these Jewish boys are so puny and delicate. They can't stand mixing dirt for 10 hours with dry biscuits to live on. Again, everywhere strange folks. No father, no mother, no caresses. There's sympathy in his voice. Well, then, you just hear a cough and the youngster's dead. Hello, Corporal. Get out of the small fry. Get out the small fry. Meaning, you know, you have to weed off the corpses. So now Herzen describes what he sees. The little ones were assembled and arrayed in a military line. It was one of the most terrible spectacles I've ever witnessed. Poor, poor children. The boys of 12 or 13 managed somehow to stand up, but the little ones of 8 and 10... No brush, however black, could convey the terror of the scene on the canvas. Meaning there's no words to describe, you know, what I've seen. And this is coming from a guy himself who's being sent off to exile. Pale, worn out, with scared looks, this is the way they stood on their uncomfortable, rough soldier uniforms, with their starched, turned-up collars, fixing an inexpressibly helpless and pitiful gaze upon the garrison soldiers who were handling them rudely. White lips, blue lines under the eyes, betokened either fever or cold. And these poor children, without care, without a caress, exposed to the wind which blows unhindered from the Arctic Ocean, were marching to their death. I seized the officer's hand, and with the words, "Take good care of them," threw myself into my carriage. I felt like sobbing, and I knew I could not master myself. I mean, it's a horrific, horrific description of what it was like. The quota would go up and down, the amounts of the percentages, I guess, of children in each town. Each town had to send a certain number of children, I guess, depending upon the overall population or size of the town, and that quota would go up or down, I guess, at need. During the Crimean War, in the 1850s, 1854, 1855, the quota was 30 per thousand males were required. In other words, 3%. 3% of all the male children had to be sent off. The system was finally abolished in 1856, almost 30 years it was in place, under Alexander II, when, in other words, Nicholas dies in 1855. In 1856, he's replaced by Alexander II. The system is abolished. The Jewish draft remains. In other words, the Jews have to go off to the army the same as everybody else. It's this cantonist system, this particularly cruel pre-military service from the ages of 12, although we've seen sometimes it was from the age of 8 until 18. And that's what's abolished in 1856. And then it's just the regular army that you have to worry about, that your number's going to get called and you're going to go. Somebody had asked earlier about how many people this affected over the 30 years or so. So there are varying numbers in the, you know, in the historical game. Figuring out numbers is always tricky. There's anything from 40 to 50,000 children is the best guesstimates. 40 and 50,000 children were affected during the 29 years of the system. And again, of course, most of them never return home. Most of them never return home. There was some there in Finland. In Finland, there's today a very small Jewish community in Finland, but apparently there were some Cantonists who, when they were released, went off and left Russia and started communities elsewhere, but they didn't have much ability to create a very strong, rich Jewish community, because from the time that they're 8 or 10 or 12 years old, they basically had been away from the Jewish community. If you Google Jews of Finland, you'll find some information on this. There's an interesting story here, which is actually not about the Cantonist system, and it's not even really about Russian Jewry, but it's evocative nevertheless. Shai Agnon, the great author Shai Agnon, who's known for his, for his literature, for his novels, I've made reference to him in the past, has a very large book. I trust the name Shai Agnon is familiar to you, and if it's not, so definitely Google it and learn something. Agnon has a book called Ir Umloa. Here you go. Ir Umloa. I guess that would be translated as, a city and its fullness. The book itself has not been translated to English. It is a 741-page chronicle of his city. He was from a Galician town called Buchach, which he sometimes immortalized in his fiction by the name Shibush. If you understand enough Hebrew or Yiddish to catch the joke in changing the name from Buchach to Shibush, so then you catch it. And it's a chronicle of the history of his town, which was a very rich Jewish town. Not rich wealthy, but rich, town of Jewish learning, of Jewish culture. Not a very large place. At its height, it maybe had 7,000 or 8,000 Jews in it. you know, the Jews probably made up a little more than half of the population of the whole town. It's bigger than a shtetl, smaller than a city in Galicia. And in this book, Ir Umloa, which has both kind of a chronicalistic tales, you know, descriptive of the rabbis of the town and the dayanim of the town and how the town was run, etc. So interspersed throughout the work are these longer pieces that read like general Agnon pieces of fiction. But they're brought to demonstrate a point, the same way that you might have, lahavdil, an agadah in a piece of Talmud. Talmud is describing factual matters, halachic matters, historical matters, whatever, what have you. And then a piece of agadah will come in order to demonstrate a point, not as a actual historical record. There's this piece here called Hane'elam, the disappeared. It's a long story. It's probably about 30 pages. I Xeroxed here just a couple of pages. Again, unfortunately, it's not available in English. This is talking not about the Cantonist system per se, not about the, you know, small children being taken away, but somebody who's drafted into the army here, not of the Russian army, but of the Austro-Hungarian army. This time, Buchach and Galicia is part of the Austrian Empire. Agnon's writing this story. This story is probably written in the 1950s, but it's describing something that happens in the early 19th century. The setting of the story is the early 19th century, probably. No, I'm sorry. The early 19th century, when Galicia is still part of the Holy Roman Empire, part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. And this idea of the city having to, the city elders, the town, the Jewish town leaders having to select who's going to go off to serve a long army service. Basically having to decide mi yecheu mi yamut, who's going to live, who's going to die. Because sending somebody off to the army, the Russian army, the Austrian army, it's a death sentence. If not a literal death sentence, then certainly a spiritual death sentence. And it's a story of a poor boy, an orphan boy. His father has died. His mother is painted in a particularly harsh light. But if you read the story carefully, you understand that it's more nuanced than that. And that he, of course, is chosen because he has no protection. He's got nobody. He's got no protectia, as we say here in Israel. He's got no money, he's got no yichus, he's got nobody to look out for him. And he's taken off, and he disappears. He never comes back. Although we, the reader of the story, know what happens to him. The people in the town, his old widowed mother, and the girl that he loves, the girl that he's promised to, the girl that's waiting for him, to come back after a certain amount of letters at the beginning of his service, he basically just disappears, and they don't know what happens to him. And the story is a story of what happened to him and what ultimately did him in. And what's particularly harsh is the way Agnon does it, with his razor sharp sense of irony and if it weren't so sad, you'd say satire. Satire implies a certain connotation of humor. Satirical humor is still funny. Here it's just so harsh and so tragic that it's difficult to say satire, because there's nothing humorous about it whatsoever. About what happens to this boy, and who's really responsible for his downfall, because it's a portrait of how corrupting the whole system was to the Jewish community itself. The degree to which it really wore down the authority of the Jewish communal leadership, the lay leadership, the rabbinic leadership. When Nicholas puts the system into play in Russia for the children, but even the whole idea that that all military conscripts were run through the Jewish community itself, the degree to which that succeeded in corrupting the Jewish community, it was very profound. Now, again, I've cautioned you in the past whenever I've done something like this, when you look at a piece of fiction, it's a piece of fiction. This is like you'd look at a novel. A historical novel is still but a novel. But it's important because it rounds out not the facts, not the historical facts, but it fills in. If you look at literature, or the right kind of literature, it can fill in the ambiance of any historical period. We obviously don't have time to read the whole story, or even just a bit of it. But let's just read a bit of it, and you'll see. And again, it's always a pleasure just to hear the beautiful Hebrew of Agnon. Interestingly, Agnon himself, Agnon was born in the summer of 1887, but he always claimed that his birthday was Tisha B'Av, 1888. Now, the fact that he chose Tisha B'Av as his birthday, just like he chose the name Agnon, he was born, his real name was Shmuel Yosef Chachkis, was his last name, Chachkis, which actually might be, you know, like the Yiddish word tchotchke, meaning like a trinket. That might be the etymology of his family name, Chachkis. He took the pen name Agnon when he came on Aliyah and published his first story, which is called Agunot, is published under the pen name Agnon. But just like he took on a pen name, he took on a pen birthday. His birthday, he always insisted, was Tisha B'Av of 1888. He was not born on Tisha B'Av, nor was he born in 1888. He was born in the summer, but of 1887. Now, this was not uncommon. It's not that he thought he was Mashiach. He was actually a Levi, so he knew he couldn't be Mashiach. But the Tisha B'Av becomes a very important date for him. Agnon, S.Y. Agnon, as he's known in English, or Shy Agnon in Hebrew. But this was not uncommon to lie about your birthday, because if instead of being born in 1887, you were born in 1888, that gave you an extra year to push off the problem of being drafted. And it gave you an extra year to hope that, you know, you'd figure out a way to get out of it. In fact, as a young man, Agnon comes to Israel, both out of sincere Zionistic commitment, but also because if you came on Aliyah as a 19-year-old, you were able to dodge that bullet, tarte mashma, of the army. And of course, there were other great Jewish figures, rabbinic figures and others, who managed to get from here to there because by doing so, they were able to avoid the possibility of being drafted. So Agnon writes, Oto hador nitchayvu. I'm sorry, let me just make this bigger as my eyes get smaller. It's harder to see. Okay. I uploaded this to the website. If you want, you can download the first, it's the first, I don't know, eight, it's for the first eight pages of the story. Oto hador nitchayvu nitchayvu Yisrael shebegalitzia lahamid anashim laavodat hatzava. At that time, in that generation, the Jewish community of Galicia had to provide people, Jews, boys, for army service. Kol kilat kimichsat nefashot shekatzva hamalchut. Each community according to the amount of souls, the amount of people that the malchut, that the kingdom dictated, had to be sent. Hayu parnasei hakiila shebechol ir mitkansim bechol shana v'shana lecheder hakiila v'yoshvin ubotkin mi manshei iram higia bno o chatno l'shnot havoda. So the town leaders would meet each year in the town hall, and they'd sit and they'd check who amongst their townsmen, whose children have come of age, whose children, whose son-in-law have come of age in military service. Im ben gedolim hu, if he's the son of gedolim, of great people, meaning wealthy people, o im ben Torah, or if he's a yeshiva student, if he's learning, if he's a very promising scholarly fellow, manichin yedehem imenu, so they'd leave him alone. Velokchim tmurato min harekim umin hapochazim, and they take the simple folk, the troublemakers, the people that were not, they were rik, they were empty, meaning they weren't rich in mitzvot or rich in any other way. Sheyafele ir lipater mihem, people that the town is happy to get rid of anyway. Ein bohem kedei michsat nefashot shekatzva malchut latetla, and if they can't meet their quota, socharin min hamishotatin shebemedina shemaskirim atzmam laavod betzava. So they would hire people that would, itinerant folk that would go from town to town, basically renting themselves out to fill the quota. And then maybe they would manage somehow to what do you call that when you ditch the army? When you desert. And then they'd go to another town and rent themselves out again to fill the quota, right? AWOL. Otam hamishotatim b'midina, otam shemaskirim atzmam l'chayel ha-melech mihem. Who are these folks that would rent themselves out to the army? Well, I'll skip ahead. V'zot lifnim b'Yisrael. And in the old days, achat b'shana, sarei ha-melech modi'im l'parnasei ha-kilot et michsat ha-nefashot shechayvim la'amid l'chayel ha-melech. Once a year, the government ministers would inform the Jewish communal leaders how many people they'd have to send. Nichnasim lebeit avad v'nosim v'notnim b'davar shelav kol adam rotze latzeit b'tzeva. Not everyone wants to go to the army. It's just Agnon, he just has this way with, as a stylist, you know, to put it all together like that. Not everyone wants to go to the army. Mipnei chilul Shabbat v'yom tov u'machlot asurot, because of the necessary desecration of Shabbat and Yantif, because of the non-kosher food, v'shara averot sheyotzei tzava ovrim aleihem, and all of the other transgressions that a person would have to transgress. Im kein ma'osim, kol sheyesh lo mamon, podeh atzmo b'mamon. Whoever has money would redeem himself with money. If you were rich, you didn't have to go because you could pay your way out of it. V'sochrim acher tachtav, and you could basically hire someone to take your place. Nefesh tachat nefesh, soul for a soul. It's a biblical quote: eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth, soul for soul, person for person, body for body. Your son, you don't want your son to go. You can afford to pay it off. They take somebody else. Meotam shamamon chaviv aleihem yoter migufam, because there are people for whom money is more precious than their bodies. V'gufam yoter minafsham, and their physical bodies are more precious than their spiritual selves, because even if you make it out bari v'shalem, you You don't get killed. You don't lose a limb in the army. So you're certainly going to lose your soul because there's no Judaism there. There's no Yiddishkeit there. There's no opportunity or possibility to maintain your faith, your practices. Umuchanim limkor nafsham kedei lekayem et gufam. Mehem shebiteh shel hamalchut hachadasha shehitzika harbe liYisrael ve'etila alayhem misim kvedim shelo haya biyadam lashalem. Ne'akru mimkomam vahayu noradim mi'ir le'ir. They'd travel from place to place if they couldn't afford to pay their taxes. Mehem b'nei hakfarim shegazra aleihem hamalchut gzeirat gerush mishum she'amra shegormim ra'a livnei mikomam shemozgim lehem yayin saruf v'hem mishtachkrim uboim lidei batala. And this was particularly true for the villagers, the b'nei kfarim. And again, this is describing the situation in Austria, but it's in Galicia, but it's true for the Russian experience, the Pale of Settlement that we described. So what happened? The b'nei kfarim, the villagers, the Jewish villagers, they were particularly in trouble, and the king would banish them away because they were this source of corruption for the non-Jewish village populations, because the Jews would be the innkeepers. They were viewed as responsible for the alcoholism and the inebriation of the masses, and because of that, if your farmers, if the tenants on your fields are drunk all the time, so that tends to cut down on the amount of time they can plow and sow and reap those fields, and that's not good for anyone. Okay. Anyway, you get a sense of all of these themes that we talked about coming together, being woven together in this historical narrative, this story, which, again, this is just by way of the background. That was just by way of the background, but it's a, if anybody's interested, if anybody wants the whole story, I can probably get you a copy of the whole story. Again, it's a long story, but it's a tragic one, and not just for the reasons that we saw. Now, to be clear, it's a tragic story, and we know who the bad guys are. We know who was responsible for this system. But that doesn't mean that there weren't other tragic figures. And it doesn't mean that there weren't others that were forced into villainous roles and forced to make horrific decisions. Decisions about individuals, but the collective force of those decisions about individuals served to really corrupt and undermine and degrade the Jewish community. And socially, sociologically, religiously, in all ways, this was a very, very, very damaging experience. Particularly damaging for the 29, 30 years of the Cantonist system, where they're taking little boys. But even after the Cantonist system is abandoned, and we're talking merely about regular army service, it was a tragic thing. I mentioned earlier, by way of introduction, this question, the Jewish question, and the final solution, the real final solution for the Jewish question, and I mean to cast no aspersions to those of you that are joining us tonight from outside of the state of Israel. But compare this whole description of the army to the fact that here our 18-year-olds also go off to the army. And although it's something we'd prefer not to have, and we await the day where there won't be an army, or at least there won't be a standing army, or there won't be a mandatory draft, seems very far away. But our whole attitude towards it, our whole sense of what happens when a boy goes off to the army here, is a completely different experience. It's a completely different experience when somebody goes off to Tzahal and what they're doing there and etc. I'm not here at all getting involved in the discussion in the news recently about yeshiva deferments and etc. I'm not discussing that at all. Just the idea that the Jewish people go off and join the Jewish army and serve and defend the Jewish people in the Jewish state. It's a complete turnaround, and it's a sign of the disease of the Galut, how it played out in the story we told tonight, versus the healthy, although clearly we still have our problems here in Israel, but the healthy society that we at least are aspiring to, and that changes the whole idea of a Jewish boy going off to the army, turns it on its head. Sherry asks, did this corruption in the Jewish leadership during the Cantonist era open the window for the Bund to gain influence? It opened the window to all types of things. It opened the window to the deterioration of the culture of Jewish leadership, and together with lots of other forces, lots of other deteriorating forces, opened up an array of possibilities and questions and phenomena, which hopefully we will see in the coming weeks, as society, Jewish society, was really very much turned on its head. So we will continue next week with that. I will stay on if anybody has any questions.